Look at the adjective. Play.
I respect you, Booker man.
And I have half the brain that you do.
Right.
A shot.
I told you.
Now is the franchise going to take the Viagra?
Gonna put some butts in the seat.
Hello there, wrestling fans, and welcome to another edition of Because WCW, the podcast where the big boys play. Thank you so much for downloading us. My name is the Twisted Genius, Dean Ayers, and I'm joined as ever by the sports journalist, the man with the blue tick, Liam Happ. How you doing, Liam?
I'm doing a lot of jet lag at the moment, to be honest, Dean.
Indeed, you only recently got back from Philadelphia, I believe.
Just over 24 hours ago, I landed back on these shores.
And you're out there for, of course, the Royal Rumble.
Oh, what wasn't I out there for? This is the glorious thing about big WWE events these days. Is, you know, a lot of companies will wisely set up camp in the same town that weekend, try and piggyback off the fans in the area. And, of course, WWE now, that you know, the Wells Fargo Arena for it, home of the Philadelphia Flyers, my beloved Philadelphia Flyers.
Yeah, I've been there myself many years ago. I happened to be in Philadelphia for the episode of SmackDown they had where Triple H beat Taz when Taz was the ECW champion back in 2000.
Yeah. Quite the episode to be there for.
I know.
These days, you never see anything notable happen on that show. But yeah, so they did a big block at Wells Fargo. They started with NXT TakeOver. I was there for that. Did the Royal Rumble, I was there for that. But I flew home before Raw and SmackDown. And if you look at what happened in all four of those shows, you'll say I got it absolutely bang on.
You picked the good ones, yeah.
Yeah, and that weren't any coincidence. If you've been watching the weeklies and the events as of late, you'll know that when it comes to this huge pay-per-view shows, WWE normally delivers in one way or another, even if it's not necessarily match quality. NXT always delivers match quality, and Raw and SmackDown deliver a whole lot of nothing. We read those signs and we're very happy with that. But before that, on the Friday, we were at the ECW Arena, which to me was a pilgrimage.
Was it now the 2300 Arena?
2300 Arena. I believe you've been there as well, haven't you, Dean?
Indeed, in my same trip to Philadelphia. See, I went to these American trips before it was cool, before they did anything. You had to find your own surrounding shows. But yeah, I was there with a good friend of mine, Sam Nee, promoter of Hearts and Essex Wrestling now. We were at CyberSlam 2000. So that was the one where Tommy Dreamer beat Taz for the ECW belt and then immediately lost it to Just Incredible.
Wow, you were out there for a shitload of stuff happening.
And we were out there for the Gary Albright Memorial Show, which was fantastic. That was like WCW, WWF and ECW wrestlers all in the same show. We got lucky in that respect.
Well, that's one thing we now have in common, Mr. Ayers, is that we've both embarked on our own separate Philadelphia wrestling pilgrimages.
And the ECW arena is tiny, isn't it?
Do you know what? I wasn't there during its original existence, and it has had, you know, it was closed down for several years, to the chagrin of several independent companies who are using it. It was then refurbed and put back in existence. And by all accounts from those who've been to the previous incarnation and the way it is now, say it is not only a little bit more spacious, you know, it's the same area, but it's much better used. Not only that, but it's much, much cleaner, because the old ECW arena had a reputation as being an absolute shithole.
It had a musty smell, shall we say. Yes.
It's the same pride that a lot of British sports fans take in going to their favourite League One or Two side, where they pee up a wall and eat salmonella and chips at half-time. It's that same sort of pride. You wouldn't change it for anything, and that's the same thing with the old ECW. But it's, you know, it's in a bit better state now. Still a very intimate venue, and I'm so glad I've seen wrestling there. And House of Hardcore to boot. So there was a lot of today's independent stars. The main event was Brian Cage versus Sami Callihan, but you know, there was a super crazy wrestled, Little Guido wrestled. And the big featured match was Tommy Dreamer and Billy Gunn taking on Nick Aldis, a former Magnus, and Joey Mercury with Shane Douglas in their corner. The good guys introduced Bully Ray as in their call, and they also had the Blue Meanie hanging around as well. The Sandman came in and cleaned house. Most of these names are ECW alumni, so it very much had that feel, especially when they took a cheese grater to the franchise's nutsack.
Oh, and I saw on Twitter you got a photo with the franchise.
Oh yes, he was. You know, we've discussed, and I'm sure we'll discuss him in future podcasts as well. He's a mixed bag as far as a performer goes, but I always had a soft spot in my heart for the franchise. And now, I got to purchase the T-shirt design of his that I always wanted as well.
Oh, good stuff. Now, what I must ask you, though, is did you tell him about this podcast? Because the thing I'm concerned about, you know, if he does listen to it and hears me slagging him off, I reckon that, you know, even at his age, he could still beat the living crap out of me with one hand tied behind his back.
Either that, or he would ban you from all Target stores across the United States of America.
God damn. I also wanted to say hello to anyone who is watching us or listening to us via the IWN Live Network. We are now part and parcel of that network. You can subscribe to that on www.iwnlive.net. It's $4.99 a month in the UK, $6.50 a month in the rest of the world. We're in some pretty good company here. They've got stuff from Battle Club Pro, Fight Nation, IPW, the High Spots Network, PCW, Wrestling Championship Wrestling, WrestlePro, plus some other podcasts such as the Buzzards Wrestling Podcast and Love the Graps, run by my good friend Alan. We're in good company, and just want to say thank you if you're listening via there. If you're not listening via there, if you're still getting us via Podbean and iTunes, stay tuned, because later on we will have as a little thank you, a little discount code for you to get some money off a subscription to IWN. So stay tuned. How's that for a teaser?
It's a big tease, Dean. Well played. But yeah, like you, I'm so excited about this link up with IWN. It's great to be in good company with a host of people who love wrestling like we do and just want to produce stuff to help fill your time and keep you entertained, a diehard wrestling fan. So that's great to be a part of something like this.
And also, you know, if people, you know, want to hear me even more than they currently do, then they can hear me on commentary with Ricky Slatter for IPW, producing some of the best UK independent shows going.
So much so that IPW belt was very much on display at the arena, thanks to Mr. Austin Aries.
Yes, well, you took a photo of him, old Austin Four Belts, and as you say, he had the IPW belt around his waist, he had the Defiant Wrestling belt in his hand. I tweeted that photo, and my goodness me, it's had more tweets, more retweets and likes than I can remember any of my tweets getting in a long time. 23,500 people have seen that. Yeah, we're getting out there. It's all good stuff.
Yeah, thanks in no small part to a little endorsement from the man himself, which is much appreciated. But that was a good photo I took. I'm very happy with that. Showing off his four-belt plumage like a peacock.
Marvellous. So if you haven't had enough Twisted Genius in your life already, I just want to tell you about some events that I am doing down on the south coast of England in sunny Worthing. We've got three evening withs hosted by Kayfabe Events, and yours truly will be the compere for all three of these evenings. First off, very soon, Friday, February the 9th, at the Charles Dickens Pub in Worthing, an evening with Robbie E from Impact Wrestling. Then the big one on Saturday, March the 31st, at St. Paul's in Worthing, right in the town centre, we have an evening with Jack Swagger, the former WWE World Heavyweight Champion. And then on Saturday, September the 3rd, again at St. Paul's in Worthing, an evening with the one and only Abyss. All of those tickets can be bought for all of those on Kayfabe Events. Look them up on Twitter or on Facebook. There's a link to tickets there. Going to be three great evenings with a devastatingly handsome compere. Shall we crack on with WCW Greed, which is the show we're covering here?
I suppose we have to. I mean, we spent 8 minutes discussing very positive, happy things, and now we're about to enter the apocalypse from our little timeline. You know, we've covered in a very brief manner. We started off this series with, you know, going from Starrcade 97, their peak, to this is their last pay-per-view, and the fact that there was only 3.5 years between them is mind-boggling. But it's a weird one. We'll go into the mixed feelings this pay-per-view provokes as we go along. But yeah, watch. I warned you of what you'd be in for watching it, and you know, you said yourself, very enjoyable pay per view, but very sad as well.
Very sad. Yeah. Well, I guess we'll get to that right at the end when we kind of just look back and think about what we've just seen. But this was the second of WCW's pay per views they're naming after the seven deadly sins, because we'd already had Sin, which I suppose isn't a deadly sin in itself, but this was the theme going, and in true WCW fashion, you have to think that they hadn't really thought this one through, because I do have to wonder how you'd be able to market a wrestling pay per view called Sloth.
Curious to see where that goes. To be honest, they did, you know, Super Brawl was in February, their second to last pay-per-view, and they called it Super Brawl Revenge, which has a nice ring to it, and I suppose that shoehorns it into the theme as well. But I always like that, Super Brawl Revenge. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, but yeah, Sloth. Slow with that. You'd have to put Kevin Nash in the main event, I guess, wouldn't you? But don't quite see how that would work. So Tony Schiavone opens up, and he's by this point, Tony Schiavone has been so worn down he can't even be bothered to do the traditional hyperbole, and it's simply, he tells us, if it's professional wrestling, then it must be greed. So presumably he's been in some of the headliners' contract negotiations, and we kick off with a special bonus match, not originally scheduled. And what have we already learnt, Liam, about a special bonus match?
Well, yeah, you're right, but do you know what? We also discuss every episode about the art of the opener. And these two actually dovetail really well here. If you're going to have an opener, you want a hot action, we'll get into that in a second, and you want a match where, you know, if you've got contests on the card where there's going to be a guaranteed crowd reaction, there's definitely a few of those which we'll discuss as we get along, you don't put them in the opening match. Something like this, you get a cold but exciting match. Yeah, first match, why not?
Yeah, it just baffles me. Why? Yeah, just don't tell people, oh, it wasn't originally meant to be on, but we've just shoved it on anyway to fill some time. So we've got Scott Hudson with Tony Schiavone on commentary. The terminally annoying Mark Madden had been fired a few months earlier, as we discussed in the last episode. And it's also actually worth noting that, as well as WCW itself, the venue for this, the Jacksonville Memorial Coliseum in Florida, didn't last much longer either. It was demolished 2 years later. This was also, just by sheer coincidence, this was also the venue for WrestleWar 92 that we looked at in episode 4.
Which makes it even sadder, because, you know, it's not just, oh, they've jinxed the venue. This is a venue synonymous with WCW.
Absolutely.
Venue, as you'll tell in the second to last match, it's, you know, very much a NWA WCW lineage here. And it's a shame that both have gone.
Yeah, so our first match, our special bonus match that therefore tells the crowd not to care about this, is Kiwi v Jason Jett. So Jason Jett was probably better known as Easy Money in ECW, which had folded 2 months prior to WCW folding, and he'd been in WCW for just 1 week by this point, and WCW folded 8 days later, so he had the worst luck.
It's his fault.
It's all his fault. I think he is the answer to that trivia question, because he was on ECW's last ever pay-per-view, and he was on WCW's last ever pay-per-view as well. Kiwi is Alan Funk, no relation to the rest of the Funk family, who's got very gelled hair sticking straight up like an electric shock. He basically looks like a pound shop Scotty Too Hotty.
Yeah, he was, you know, he'd been around for about 6 months, last 6 months of WCW, I think. He was a combination of eccentric and borderline effeminate, I should say flamboyant, I suppose, but, you know, they pretty much hammered these things home, and it got even less subtle when he went to TNA and played an effeminate character. So, he was always, the idea was, I think at this point they added a temper as well, but he was like a style consultant who was very flamboyant, and, you know, but if you made him angry, he'd absolutely lose it, but...
Yes, he would transform into a different, more aggressive wrestler known as Angry Alan. That was the idea. Yeah. So as you said, the crowd are cold. They've been kind of told not to worry too much about this, but they pop for an early high spot. Kiwi hasn't learned to work the hard cam yet, because he had a great submission on with his back to the hard cam. And then he manages to miss what I've described as the worst looking tope in history that would have missed even if Jason Jett had stayed still. It was kind of fell well short. But they kind of quickly cover over that. And you know, there's some innovative offense from Jason Jett here. And I've got to say, you know, I really did rate him. I remember he worked one show for the FWA a few years later. And he was really, to me, he was one of those really underrated creative wrestlers. I really liked him.
Yeah, you talk about creative. I think at one point he ended up designing wrestlers' gear and entranceware. Yeah.
So, Easy Tights was his company.
He definitely had that flair for the creative side of wrestling. This match, though, I'm going to stick to this, you know, a match like this, you know, it's fine if it has no build-up or anything because it's the opening match, no less, in a hot WCW territory, one of the last ones remaining up to their dying days. They could always do Jacksonville and have a decent crowd. And, they just start, right from the get-go, getting all their shit in, as they'll say in the industry. Just immediately getting all their moves in, one after the other. And the crowd pop for it because it's the first match. It's a fast pace, as you said, crazy moves on display. And this is exactly what Jason Jett did in that very brief WCW tenure. He just went balls to the wall. And it worked, you know. If WCW carried on, he would have had a bright, you know, could have had a cruiserweight title reign or two in his future. He probably would have been put in line for the belt not too long afterwards. And this was very much a showcase for him. Funk gets some spots in as well. But I've got to say, as much as this was very effective at the time, I remember everyone raving about this match and raving about Jason Jett. Watching it the other day for this podcast just show me that that really doesn't hold up. It doesn't stand the test of time for me. As I said, it's one of the things where both guys decide, you know, let's get our moves in. Sod everything else, just get our moves in. A few of the things are very contrived and very, you know, the selling was non-existent. There's DDTs on the floor, pole drivers, they were just getting up and bouncing around and doing the next spot. But obviously, I'll give them one bit of credence here. Back in 2001, 2002-ish, this was very common, unfortunately. That was a way of wrestling. But yeah, watching it back, it's nowhere near as good a belt as it seemed at the time.
Yeah, but I mean, do you know what you say about, you know, not much selling, getting all your spots in? There's still, to this day, a lot of independent wrestling is still like that. It's, you know, it's about just taking the crowd on this, building them up on this journey, right? You know, and hitting your moves rather than necessarily telling a story. You know, you still see that a lot today, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And there's one thing about Easy Money, Jason Jett's moveset. This was frustrating in ECW a lot of the time, and it was frustrating here, is that he goes through all these wild moves, and then he finishes the match with, it's called the Crash Landing. Had a different name in ECW, just escapes me for the time being. Might have been the Money Clip or something like that. But this move where he lifts them up for a suplex and flips them, so they do almost like a somersault onto their back. It's not the worst finisher in the world, but compared to everything else he hits in the match, it looks like soddle. And so he does all this crazy stuff and then hits this lame suplex and gets the pin, which is crazy how he does that. That's one thing about his creative process that I'd call into question.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I suppose you could argue that, you know, it's all the other big moves has worn your opponent down. I mean, there's one, but you know, you're saying about getting all their stuff in. There's a top rope power bomb that he reverses into a Hurricane Rana, and it just looks risky as hell because they both nearly land on their head. That really did make me draw a sharp intake of breath. But I thought the match picked up pace in the last few minutes. It built nicely into the finish, and yeah, his crash landing suplex, he remembers to direct to the hard camera. I thought they did a great job of winning a cold crowd over, and one thing as well from this, which is different to the Russo era, they were given a decent amount of time, 12 minutes to be precise.
Yeah, it's a textbook opener. This is what I'd want an opener to be. And, you know, even though I just said to the contrary, I could spin it round and say they understood the current audience in that climate by doing a spot fest, because it was much more accepted then than it is now. So they went for that. They gave them something to sink their teeth into. They went at the right pace for an opener. And that's where you stick a cold match like that, because, you know, your storylines can wait till later in the show when the crowd should sustain their excitement on the grounds that they're invested in it. So they did their job admirably here. For all the little nitpicks I can make 16, 17 years on, they did a great job.
For the time. I think, absolutely spot on. And I'd agree with you. It's not a match that holds up as a great match these days, but in at the time, definitely filled its purpose. I mean, you look how often the three count and the Young Dragons and variations of those just threw everything in there as spot fest openers, just to get the, and then that's what you do. Yeah, you get the crowd going. Okay, so we have a recap of the WCW Cruiserweight Tag Team Tournament, which featured, among others, a young AJ Styles getting his first national break. But we're now crowning the first ever WCW Cruiserweight Tag Team Champions. But don't worry, I know what you're thinking. Even though the company did cease to exist 8 days later, they still managed to have a title change in those 8 days, because, after all, this is WCW.
You say, let's get through this match first, but I kind of liked what they did on the finale of Nitro. So, yeah, let's look at this match before I talk about that. But, yeah, so we got Ray and Kidman, who, you know, they're in the tournament there. It'd be daft not to put them in the finals. If you want to, even if they don't win, you know, spoiler alert, they don't. But, you know, having them in the final is instant credibility, because not too many other people in that current roster scream out not just tag team wrestling, former WCW heavyweight tag champs, but especially the cruiserweight division like Ray and Kidman. So that's a fantastic choice to steer the tournament. And they're up against Elix Skipper, who, you know, been there 6 months, had a couple of, I think maybe had one cruiserweight title reign, I'm sorry, but looked good a lot of the time. And we've got Kid Romeo, who pretty much debuted for this tournament.
Yes, I mean, he is, I was thinking, I had no recollection of Kid Romeo, I have to say. He wasn't someone that got picked up after WCW was bought by Vince McMahon, but he was a former male stripper who trained at the power plant, and he just looks so 2001. It took me back just looking at that, of what people looked like at that time. He had the hair, the way his hair was all gelled, and the shiny pleather trunks, the necklace, the chiseled physique, the generic tatter around the bicep. If you just showed a picture of someone and said what year was this photo taken, you would say, you know, turn of the millennium, bang on.
Not only that, Dean, but you said he was a former male stripper, and he also looks very much exactly like a male stripper. But Buff Bagwell was another one notorious for that. You know, you could tell he had worked in that industry and would go on to work in that industry as well. But he at least made an effort to turn his persona into a typical professional wrestler with his graffitied gear and things like that. Now, Kid Rome comes out and looks like he's just done a shift at the nearby bar to a crowd of 37 screaming middle-aged women. But, you know, he at the time at least, he was short-lived, but he wasn't a bad wrestler. I liked how he could fly a little bit, but he would attempt to ground. You know, as a cruiserweight heel, it's great to have one who'd attempt to ground their opponent, but could actually fly a little bit as well, so he tapped into the style. And that's exactly what we saw here. You know, Skipper and Romeo, they early doors, they play pinballs for exciting offense from Kidman and Ray, as we know they can pull off. Kidman and Ray always going to be over with the crowd, well established. So, you know, they bounce around great for them, and that gets the match off to a great start.
Yeah, I mean, something that I think we'll say more than once in this podcast was, I mean, the cruiserweight tag team titles, I know it's another set of belts, but do you know what? To me, it was a great idea. And to introduce these belts, and the idea of, you know, being able to bring younger guys, smaller guys, new fresh blood into the company, it was a great idea. But, you know, it was just a matter of too little too late by this stage, because all the damage had been done in the previous years. The rot had set in. It was irreversible by this point. And unlike what we said about the previous match, to me this was a great match, a fast-paced match. It would still hold up fine today.
Definitely. I thought it was, you know, if I was to give out the old Meltzer-esque star ratings at the time, I would have had this above the opener. And
yeah,
you look at it now and it's not even close. With all due respect to the opener, we gave it enough praise, but yeah, this match is a legit... I have it in a 4-star region, to be honest. It was a great match.
I mean, there's some good, great double team moves. There's a spot where Skipper gets hip tossed off the ramp, so he lands upside down on top of Kid Romeo, who's on the floor at the side of the ramp. And as you say, you know, Skipper and Romeo are really good foils to the baby faces. The heels win the bout when Romeo catches a springboard moonsault from Mysterio and pins him clean with an emerald frozen that he calls the Last Kiss.
And what a finish that was. The execution, I have to add this, the execution was spot on. He spiked him. And he was safe as houses, Ray, in reality. But it just looked so good. And when you have a good match on with a great finish like that, that really raised your estimation, because that's what you remember above all else.
And you need to have something big to get a clean pin on Rey Mysterio, basically. You know, that's another thing. But to me, they just didn't make a big deal of them being the first ever champs. Romeo actually throws the belt down on the floor to dance instead. You know, that's just bizarre to me. You know, when you think about, you know, the fuss that, for example, you know, WWE made when Paige became the first ever NXT Women's Champion, or when Charlotte Flair became the first women's champion after being the Divas belt, or anything where new belts been added, you know, you make a big deal because no one else will ever be the first ever champs. And it just seems to be a bit of an afterthought. And it does make you wonder how much the people in the ring knew that the company they're wrestling for was literally days away from death.
Yeah, they pretty much knew the Fusion thing was dead in the water at this point. It was pretty much, they may not have announced it formally to the entire roster, but they knew that TV on Time Warner was no longer going to be a thing, and I'm sure we'll go into extreme detail on that at the end of this podcast. But yeah, by this point, by the time the pay-per-view happened, they were very much in the air that it weren't happening. I think Eric Bischoff did he dialed in via telephone during the contract signing between Scott Steiner and Booker T the very next night on Nitro, pretty much said that, they'd hit a massive wall in trying to buy the company and things were very much up in the air. But, so it is hanging over them. It's very much on their minds. And again, to be honest, it's also a little bit in character for them to drop the belts and dance. And they did show them a lot more respect in a rather questionable backstage segment a little later in the show.
Yeah, so, and as I said, the Filthy Animals won the belts from them on the last ever Nitro. But this was another good bout that was given plenty of time, 14 minutes for that one.
Yeah, the main reason for that is, well, it's, I think it's twofold. On the final Spring Break Nitro was a happy result for the telecast. They don't know where they're going, so make everyone happy. There's a lot of very popular results on that last Nitro, you know what I mean? And not only that, but I think they did try and shift the belts as much as they could onto employable people, because WWF had very, very much, they owned WCW by the time the final match happened. And Kidman was a lock, and they were very optimistic of getting Ray to sign on, even though it wouldn't actually happen for another year or so. So that killed the belts off for sure. Not that they would have lasted much longer anyway in that company. But yeah, it was also to put them on the guys who would actually be around. Whereas Skipper and Romeo at best are probably going to be heads developmental, which is exactly what happened.
So we then go to our first backstage segment of the evening. And I say the first one because, oh my God, there's tons of them. And they basically don't serve much of a purpose as far as I'm concerned. We have a backstage segment with Buff Bagwell, who's got his own camcorder cameraman. And it's one of those, you know, where they do the screen effect as if it's recording off a camcorder, even though you wouldn't see it like that if you're watching a camcorder footage back. But hey, this is WCW. He goes into the CEO Ric Flair's office. Flair is with Jarrett and Road Warrior Animal, who are all part of a stable together. This was just really weird. It went nowhere. Everyone was talking over each other, and I can't actually really understand what they're saying half the time. So it was just it was a bit weird.
Yeah, just heels trying to put themselves over. It wasted time, really. It was very Horseman-esque in the whole hiring a cameraman to cover stuff, which they famously did with the big Dusty Rhodes attack that everyone remembers so fondly. And I've got a lot of respect for any attempt to explain why there's magically a camera there, because you get a lot of, you know, it's a very big trope in wrestling where they just happen to be filmed at any given moment. This is explained. The guys hired a cameraman for self-promotion, so if it does pick up any other stuff after, that's why there's a cameraman sitting there. So I admire that, but it actually went hardly anywhere at all.
Whereas I suppose nowadays, everyone just films everything they're doing on their phones anyway, so you wouldn't actually need much of an explanation. But hey, our third match is Sean Stasiak with Stacy Keibler, as she is now known, versus Bam Bam Bigelow. Keibler comes out in her old Miss Hancock getup, and obviously we last saw her as Miss Hancock for what was the show we did?
New Blood Rising. And Dean, I do not blame you one bit for shutting that out of your mind.
Yeah, I suppose that's a fair point. You don't really want to remember New Blood Rising,
do you? I'm just gutted that I still do. I'm jealous. Why can't I be the one with like 12 concussions?
Hey, it's only five. Oh, come on, man. Sorry. Ironically, I remember the number of concussions, just not other things. Stacy Keibler is now with Sean Stasiak, as opposed to David Flair, and she's clearly not pregnant, which was alluded to at New Blood Rising. Stasiak's got this god-awful entrance music that Shivani calls the superstar entrance, and then he cuts an equally awful, generic and monotone promo that is just blah. I'm sorry, it just doesn't do anything. He's known as the Mecca of Manhood, which really doesn't make sense, because Mecca's a place. You know, it's like me calling myself the Royal Pavilion of Obesity or something. Do you know what I mean? It just doesn't make any sense.
And yet, I still think you should use that.
Okay, maybe we can put that in the intro.
I'd be happy to.
The Twisted Genius is over. It's now the Royal Pavilion of Obesity. So after the first two matches, this is a real change of pace. It's slow, it's plodding, it's outdated heel work from Stasiak. And considering how good he could be when he made the effort, Bigelow is either injured or just phoning it in by this point. He gets distracted by Stacy, gets hairspray in his eyes from Stasiak, and is pinned with a neck breaker. It's just especially after the first two matches, is really poor.
Yeah, it's a piss break. And that's not a bad thing, given that there's a lot of matches containing very good wrestlers on this, so it's going to be a high pace. It's not the worst thing in the world to have this little breather. I've got to be very honest, even though in ring wise Sean Stasiak was very bad, even when he was in the tag team, couldn't seemingly cover up what he couldn't do. I have to admit that this late rush of Mecca of Manhood the last 2 weeks of WWE, it was a guilty pleasure of mine. It was so naff, it was good. It was very old school heel. His delivery wasn't great, but I liked he and Stacy Keibler's mannerisms. They had a certain little chemistry together, and Stacy Keibler's just really underrated for being a heel valet. I feel obliged to also just backtrack. So we covered that whole mess at New Blood Rising where she had stomach cramp. It turned out she was pregnant, blah, blah, blah. I think they did a thing on Nitro where she was going to shotgun marry David Flair. She runs out at the ceremony saying the baby's not his. Apparently there was talk that it was maybe going to be revealed that Vince Russo was the father, because not only does he want to portray himself as the WCW champion and the hardest man alive, he wants people to think that he could actually nail Stacy Keibler. In the end, it just all went no. Obviously, Vince Russo got the boot once and for all, and she was gone for a while. Then she shows up. This was just before this pay-per-view. She showed back up on Nitro, promising to show off her baby. Out comes Sean Stasiak. And I think they had a pram full of photos of Sean Stasiak, which I liked. That whole thing they do, they do this thing here where they throw out the photos of Sean. I liked that. There was little things about it that I liked. But yeah, he couldn't back it up in the ring. And on the mic, he weren't great either.
So I was going to say, there are photos of Sean Stasiak at ringside for this match, weren't there?
Yeah. He's a sort of guy, crazy as it sounds, if WCW had carried on and I was in charge, I would have done something, because Extreme has stuck the US title on him, because heat-wise, people would enjoy seeing him get beat, and if he dodged it for a few months, it'd be quite fun. There was enough about him that I liked, even though he wasn't great in the ring. But yeah, this was, and I agree with you about Bigelow. What I think it might have been is, you know, so sometimes wrestlers are as good as their dance partner, and I think he was definitely playing down to Stasek's level. So it weren't, yeah, worth watching at all. But yeah, I got a titter out of rewatching this.
Yeah. Okay, so next matchup is Team Canada, which is Lance Storm and Mike Awesome against Hugh Morris and Conan. Lance Storm gets the mic. He shows Sean Stasiak how to do an in-ring promo. And I love his serious face and the glaring eyes. Absolutely fantastic. Now, at New Blood Rising, Awesome was Storm's opponent. Now they're tag partners. How did that come about, Liam?
So Mike Awesome had a bit of a weird time after New Blood Rising. This was where he'd end up as the Fat Chick Thriller soon afterwards. Then he was that 70s guy. It was just a nightmare. And thankfully, as soon as Russo got Das Boot, as we touched upon earlier, they thought, well, we've got this talented big man here who's been portrayed successfully as a killer all across the world. How about we hit the reset button and portray him as a talented big man killer who's been successful all across the world? And wouldn't you know it, even though it's a tenuous link with him joining Team Canada, he's not Canadian. You know what? It worked in getting Elix Skipper established in WCW, and it's still a hell of a lot better than that fucking 70s guy. So why not? Suddenly, Team Canada trimmed the fat. You know, Elix Skipper moved on to cruiserweight stuff, which was better for him given the nature of what Team Canada do versus what he can do in the cruise division. They got rid of that oaf Hacksaw Jim Duggan, etc., 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 and they find themselves seriously challenging to be next in line for the tag titles. And I believe this was to secure the next shot at those belts, this match. And they're facing, and I like this about it, it's you know, it's not the most appealing match on the card, but they're facing two guys in Conan and Hugh Morris who used to head up the Misfits in Action and the Filthy Animals, respectively, who were Team yep. Canada's two biggest forms in their side during their existence. And, you know, their factions have fallen away and gone on to other things, but they've decided they still can't stand Lance Storm and they can't stand Mike Awesome going, throwing them around and putting them through tables every week. So they bond together and they're going to stick it to their enemies. And I like that. You know, it was a nice, simple build. It was a good way to use four guys they want on the card, even though they're not doing anything more important. And it's an okay match, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of a paint-by-numbers tag match. I mean, I've got to say, it's a little bit clumsy at times. When Awesome's in, he just seems to be off a beat. I mean, as you said, you know, he's known around the world. I've seen plenty of his matches before. He can be absolutely fantastic. He just seems to be a little bit off today. The crowd aren't into it all that much. But Awesome, yeah, it's nothing bad, nothing brilliant, basically. Awesome gets the win for Team Canada with a running powerbomb on Hugh Morris while Storm holds Conan's leg at ringside to stop him from making the save. So, yeah, it just sort of advances the story, I guess, doesn't it?
Yeah, they get a title shot. They're very worthy challengers for the champions. So we've got the match coming up, so I won't say their names, even though it's by no means a spoiler. We'll get to that, though. I'm looking forward to getting to that. But, yeah, challenges established, feud ended, move on.
Yeah. Can you have spoilers for something that's like 17 years old?
You,
I don't know.
You absolutely cannot. And yet every time we do this podcast, I feel really uncomfortable going ahead of myself in chronological order.
Now, we then go to another backstage segment. Now, this is actually done reasonably well, actually, because rather than having some, you know, when you're saying about why cameras are there and stuff, this is supposedly from a security camera inside the dressing room of Dusty and Dustin Rhodes. That is recording, which you know, on the one hand it's quite good if, you know, someone tried to nick your wallet. On the other hand, I wouldn't want a camera in my dressing room when I'm getting changed. But we see Dusty getting a huge tray of burritos delivered to the dressing room, and we then go back to Buff Bagwell's camcorder documentary. Again, nothing of any relevance is happening here. Please can we go back to the wrestling?
I'll tell you before we go back to the wrestling, your two segments here, not huge additions to the show, mixed results as far as how watchable they are, and yet you can tell that you know who is no longer in charge of WCW, because shock horror, in the last few months, WCW is at least attempting to have things make sense. And
the
production value is the reason why. It's no coincidence they've actually started trying the logical thing. It's too little too late, but at least they're trying. We'll take a try rather than just utter garbage.
And you know, the other thing as well is that we're not telling viewers that actually all of this is fake and scripted. And you're just taking it for what it is.
Yeah, we're actually trying to give even little backstage segments context. Every, you know, the proverbial zipper is being hidden on the costume and people can suspend their disbelief. Who the funk it?
But it's, yeah, this is basically all building up to Dusty supposedly eating all these burritos and having terrible wind, which is really not, I just didn't think it was needed in the match because it doesn't, when they get to it, but because it's not really any part of the match. But we'll come on to that later on when we have the Dusty and Dustin Rhodes v Flair and Jeff Jarrett match. We then go to a painfully generic promo from Chuck Palumbo and Sean O'Hare. You know, the power plant, they taught you how to wrestle, but they really didn't teach people how to do promos very well. And then after the wrong caption is put on the screen, it is time for our Cruiserweight Championship match where Shane Helms takes on Chavo Guerrero Jr.
Yeah, and at this stage, I think I've touched on this before, but I'll say it again, and I'm happy to be quoted on this. I really believe, despite the sheer amount of talent available in WWE at this point in early 2001, they had some great workers, obviously, during the peak of their run. I'd still put Chavo at this specific time in the top 10 workers in the world. Even if just for a 3 to 4 month period, he was absolutely incredible as he pretty much dragged the Cruiserweight division back to relevance for a few months before it pretty much went off a cliff under someone else's ownership. But it was shaped like this match was a bit of a shame in a way. He faced Shane Helms when Helms was very much one half a three count and seemed a bit of a surprise guy to earn a Cruiserweight title shot at pay-per-view. But he did. He tore the house down. Sin.
Yeah.
Chavo then proceeded to carry Rey Mysterio to one of the best matches of the year on a clear off night for Rey. And that match at Super Bowl was a must watch just to see Chavo pretty much do a one man job with someone who's normally carrying the other guys he's wrestling. But this match, this is the logical conclusion. You know, three count of turf, Shane Helms, he's got his own music, his own look. This is his crowning moment where he's going to play off that great match with Chavo and all those other great matches they had. And they had a bit of a pedestrian match here. It was good, it had its moments, but for half the match, they really struggled to get the crowd's attention. I even heard a boring chant. It picked up, thankfully, but it really felt like Shane Helms' big moment should have been a lot more than this thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, you said, you know, he has his own music now. He even came down with his own dance troupe because he was Sugar Shane Helms, his own dance troupe, who they called the Sugar Babes, I think, which I'm sure was a British pop band with an ever-changing lineup. But the group appeared to be, I think it was made up of the remaining Nitro girls who weren't shoved into the valet roles that they didn't want in the first place. Now, yeah, I'd say this is a good match and a great match, but the one thing I think, one thing I noted here, Chavo is great because one of the things I've often bemoaned at previous WCW main events or previous WCW championship matches, this one has the intensity of a championship match. And I guess the lack of intensity in the previous match emphasizes it here. And Chavo comes across, you know, as you say, he's in the absolute peak of his career at this point. He comes across as a champion who does not want to lose his belt and will go to any means to defend it, and that to me is the most important thing about any kind of championship match. You know, you put the championship belt as the top priority,
and it plays off so well against the fact he's facing a young guy who's just fallen into the singles division based off one amazing standout performance. It's a great dynamic, and it makes me really think it must have just been the climate of wrestling at times. The only explanation why Jet and Kiwi in the opener can get such a reaction, you know, they're in the opener, which always works that way, but they just throw their moves out there and it works with great success. These guys work a story, they try and slow burn it, and 2001 wrestling fans do not want to know about it. And they tune back in when they start hitting big moves towards the end.
Yes, builds up nicely. Near falls that could easily win the match. Helms wins after 14 minutes with a vertebraker, which is a great move that you just don't see anymore for obvious reasons, because people want to protect their necks these days. So he wins the belt, and he actually went into the WWE as the reigning WCW World Cruiserweight Champion.
He did. They moved it off of him pretty quickly to Billy Kidman, who they deemed more marketable, which can be seen as a bit of an insult at times, but... No, he found his feet with the Hurricane persona, which seemed like a mugging off at first, but he owned it so well, and that was the first time that's the one thing that was lacking from his package as he broke through as a single star with his Sugar Shane thing was, he's a great wrestler, but he didn't have the charisma, didn't have the mic skills, but the Hurricane actually turned him into an all round performer. So that was one of those happy coincidences, one of those lucky turns that went really well.
And of course, he showed up at the Royal Rumble that you attended.
Yeah, that was great. I saw some people moaning about him only being there for 30 seconds. I'm like, are you kidding me? Why would you want the Hurricane in there for more than 30 seconds? He went in, tried to do a chokeslam like he always used to, fouled and got kicked out. I'm pretty sure he entered a couple of Rumbles during his actual employ with WWE and did the exact same thing, and everyone loved it. So I thought it was a great cameo. He was used perfectly.
What kind of reaction did it get live, just out of interest?
Oh, it got a huge reaction. It did not compare to Ronda Rousey at the end or Rey Mysterio coming out. I'd say Rey was probably the biggest pop for an entrant coming out. But then Shinsuke winning the Rumble with all that suspense, because it was well done at the very end. They knew to employ a couple of liked wrestlers against a couple of wrestlers who the Philadelphia crowd do not like, and it worked beautifully.
I was in the Clapham Ground in London for Hooked on Wrestling, our friends at Hooked on Wrestling, who run various pay-per-view viewing parties around the country. And it was crazy because there was 450 people who went to a venue in South London to watch a wrestling show that was on from midnight till 4 o'clock in the morning. It was crazy. But the reaction, there was such a huge pop when Mysterio came out. And a pretty good pop when the Hurricane came out as well. So I was interested to see how it compared to being there live.
Deservedly so, he got a good reaction because we're here covering Greed, which was his breakout. Like with a few guys on the roster at this point, it was too little, too late in one sense. But he did survive. He survived, and a lot of people did not. Jason Jett didn't, Kid Romeo didn't, but he survived. He broke out. He made the most of it. He had a good career, and he still shows up every now and then. People remember who he is. So that's a really good sign of what he did, despite WCW closing at the worst possible time. He had a happy ending. I'm so glad for him.
Absolutely. You think about, if the Hurricane came out compared to, like, I don't know, if Mordecai or someone came out and the reaction that might get, and that tells you the difference between the reception and the longevity of those gimmicks, I guess.
Exactly.
Anyway, we have another camcorder backstage skit with Flair and Jarrett where, again, nothing of consequence is said, and it really doesn't the promo's meant to make you look forward to see a match, and I'm just thinking, can you please get on with the wrestling here? Booker T rescues things with a better promo where he looks ahead to his US title match with Rick Steiner. And then we go on to match number 6, which is for the WCW World Tag Team Champions, as the team of Totally Buffed, which is Luger and Bagwell, take on the natural born thrillers of Chuck Palumbo and Sean O'Hare. So it's 2001. Lex Luger's body still looks outstanding, but his face is now looking really old. A pre-match promo from Luger and Bagwell gets little to no reaction. It's just interesting looking at the aesthetics of this match with 2018 eyes, because unlike today, at 2001, physique was still king. And you had so many of these guys coming out of the power plant who looked amazing physically but couldn't always perform in the ring, whereas nowadays you look at the likes of I'm just thinking of like a Kevin Owens, Cassius Ohno, people like that who are employed for their wrestling ability as opposed to their physique. It's a totally different world that we're living in now. The promos lasted longer than the actual match, because after a Shawnton bomb, the Natural Born Thrillers retained their tag titles in just 54 seconds. I don't know what the story behind this one was, but surely Luger and Bagwell couldn't have been happy doing a job in under a minute.
Ah, well, this is why I was happy on this instance, Dean, to let you get through the match and then save my stuff for afterwards, because there's so much to discuss about this. And you know what? I'm not exactly, you know, no one has ever said to me firsthand what has happened. By all accounts, the prevailing opinion is that Luger and Bagger have been told to put over the new team. You know, two guys from the Thrillers who have actually managed to break out from the generic Jack-looking guy stable pack. And they were, you know, the Thrillers were jobbers for the most part. And out of that came O'Hare and Palumbo, who used to team with other members, you know, Jindrak and Stasiak.
Mike Sanders, people like that, I would assume.
Yeah, Sanders was the mouthpiece. Almost everyone else was Mr. Muscle in the group. Very green, very generic, mostly job boys for Kevin Nash. But out of that came O'Hare and Palumbo. They had the intensity and their chemistry, and they actually looked like a good team, so much so that they actually put them over Nash and DDP in a semi-clean match at Sin, and they went on a bit of a tear towards the end of the show, to the point where they went to establish them with a win over Luger and Bagwell, who, you know, if those they were carried on, they were going to be sacrificial lambs for a returning Goldberg soon enough anyway. By all accounts, they were asked to lose clean in 8 minutes, and instead they went out and did this, and you know, overselling everything, this, that, and the other. Now, Lex Luger, the shoot interviewer, I was trying to track it down before we sat down to record this, but there was definitely a shoot interview, maybe with RF Video, where he was asked about this, and he insists they were asked to lose decisively less than 8 minutes, and that Bagwell was going to be pinned. And Luger says, and take his grace all you will, but this is his side story. He says he suggested that they lose in even less time as being suggested, and they both get pinned because, you know, those guys were moving on to other things anyway. Obviously, they're, you know, Luger was 40, 41 at this point. Showed a bit in the shoot, he showed a bit of self-awareness of that. And he seemed to like O'Hare and Palumbo, going by the way he's speaking. So that's his side of it.
Okay.
That they just thought, well, sorry, let's just go nuts. And, you know, it does fit the Luger mantra in a way where he will put someone over in 2 minutes if it means he's getting paid the same amount of money for 2 minutes' work. But, yeah, the prevailing opinion, including that of Dave Meltzer, is that this was similar to Shawn Michaels versus Hulk Hogan, where Shawn didn't like the fact that Hogan would not lose for him anyway, shape or form. So he went out there and he did Wile E. Coyote selling the whole way.
Yeah.
And as you see, after there's another segment coming up, but then after that you see they're still in the ring selling, you know, a very short, you know, I'm sure it's devastating when they hit their finishers fast, but they've been beaten up for a minute and they're still out cold in the ring. But, you know, again, the promo they cut was, yeah, it didn't sit great with the fans, but it was clearly an attempt to come across as arrogant, entitled veterans. And they even got the line in, yeah, you know, don't get too comfortable, this ain't going to last long, which is clearly to ironically set up the fact that it didn't last long in O'Hare and Palumbo's favour. So there is reason to believe that they've really done them a turn here, but there's also, given Luger and Bagwell's histories, there's a lot of reason to believe that they've done this to try and sandbag it. So I don't know, but it's a curious match.
That's interesting. That's, well, I thought there had to be a story behind it. And then, as you say, we have another promo. It's Scott Steiner basically shouting not so sweet nothings at the camera. And then we're supposed to go to the next match, but Bagwell is still down. And this is what I don't like. The commentators make note of his previous neck injury. And, you know, my note, I'd written on my notes, I wasn't sure what the point of this was, if it wasn't actually a legit injury, but maybe it was just to fill a bit of the time that they hadn't wrestled for.
Yeah, I'm... Percy, you just say, look, they got their commandments, they got their ass kicked. I did like a line from Scott Hudson right towards the end of the actual match / non-match, where he said, this was a Georgia Championship Wrestling squash. I love that reference. Probably not the sort of thing to address on air, you could argue, but I kind of like that line. I like Scott Hudson, so I'll let him get away with it. But yeah, so you don't touch upon something that's actually quite sobering, especially when you try and say, look, these guys are part of the These guys are part of the Magnificent Seven. Heel faction, no one likes them. They talk a load of crap. They just got served by the new hot thing. They're portraying these guys as the tag team equivalent of Goldberg, which is why they shouldn't have cut a promo early in the show, because you just have them come out, win their match in a minute. They'll get over. They were over at the end of WCW. They got a job with WWE, which exposed how inexperienced they were because of these last 3 months of looking great. So, yeah, it can work.
So match number 7 is Canyon against Ernest the Cat Miller, who is accompanied by Ms. Jones, who I believe was one of the former Nitro girls shoved into a valet role that she didn't necessarily want, as we covered previously. Canyon comes out from through the stage, Wrestle Kingdom style. Miller taunts Canyon with a promo on the ramp. I know I've said it before, but Ernest the Cat Miller was one of my guilty pleasures in wrestling. Okay, he couldn't wrestle much, but he was so entertaining on the mic.
Nothing guilty about it, Dean. Come on, he was great. He weren't a good wrestler, but personally and charisma-wise, as soon as he got this whole I'm the greatest persona going on, he was one of the highlights of the show. There's nothing guilty about it, in my opinion.
And am I right in saying when he went to the WWE, he had the Somebody Call My Mama music that they gave to Brodus Clay, I think,
didn't they? He was the originator of that theme, yeah.
Ah, we do love a recycled theme, as we'll find out later on. Canyon goes after Ms. Jones. Canyon basically... This is a Canyon show. He bumps all over the place for Ernest the Cat Miller. And as we said, Miller can't wrestle to save his life. But the martial arts offense that he does, obviously, looks amazing, being a former world champion. He has bundles of charisma. It's a short, entertaining match. Canyon gets a 3 count, but his foot was on the ropes. Miller hits the feliner, as he calls it, which is a discus roundhouse kick. But Canyon gets his foot on the ropes to break the fall. So it's a nice little touch, which the commentators completely miss. Canyon nails the ref from behind with the cast that he's got on his wrist. Ms. Jones gets in the ring. Miller grabs Canyon's arms behind his back. Ms. Jones goes to kick Canyon, but accidentally hits Miller. She then gets pulled out by Canyon, but she hits him with a kick. Miller recovers, as does the ref. And then Ernest Miller wins the match with a second feliner kick. And then just to make the result kind of irrelevant, Canyon then jumps Miller from behind, hits a flatliner, which I don't like it when that happens, because basically no sells the impact of a finisher. You know, he's just hit you with his finisher and moments later you're getting back up to attack him. You know, it's different if it's a quick roll up, but when it's someone's finisher, it should be the end of it.
Yeah.
And then MI Smooth runs in to save Miller and Canyon. Canyon makes a sharp exit. And my note here just says, MI Smooth, who the hell was he?
He was the Cat's limo driver at this point. I think they introduced him when the Cat was the Hill Commissioner, and he's stuck loyal to him ever since.
He wasn't a wrestler, was he?
He was Ice Train, I believe. He was in WWE.
No way, was that Ice Train?
Let me just double check.
Jesus, he like shrunk. Hell of, if that is Ice Train, he'd gone on to homeopathic remedies, shall we say.
Harold Fitzgerald Hogue is an American former professional wrestler. He is best known for his tenure with WCW, where he wrestled under the ring names Ice Train and MI Smooth. So he's a regurgitated 90s WCW failure. But this match did have a bit of backstory. Canyon was feuding with DDP, which was always on again, off again. DDP shook him off with a win on Nitro, I think, and Canyon, for whatever reason, snapped. And he attacked the Cat, attacked Miss Jones, which was the big thing, and he also laid out MI Smooth for good measure as well, which is why he's got this vendetta with all of them. This is why Miss Jones is so determined to get in a ring and face off for him, because she's spunky, etc., etc. These two have good chemistry. You know, one brings one aspect, as you mentioned. The other brings another aspect to it. You got a guy holding the mechanics together, because Canyon was so underrated in the ring. And the Cat just entertains. You know, he's the main reason the crowd are reacting. Because I don't think Canyon's attempt to be a serious maniacal heel didn't really work. He was hilarious when he was positively Canyon. He was great just being his usual arrogant braggart self. But this was an overstretch trying to sell him as serious, and the Cat carries the personality of this match.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, as you said, you know, Canyon could do so many good things. So many good things.
But Achilles Heel was not one of them.
No. We have more camcorder footage backstage as Luger and Bagwell, who's now recovered, clearly are arguing backstage. And Bagwell loses his rag when he discovers that the cameraman, who he told to film everything, has filmed this, which I thought was quite a funny little touch.
Yeah, that was good.
Then we're back to Dusty and Dustin's security cam, and it appears that Dusty is farting a lot after eating all those burritos. And remember, folks, if you're watching this live, you're paying your hard-earned money to watch Dusty Rhodes fart.
There is a payoff, Justine. You kind of skipped it earlier, but there is a payoff. Mm. As Jarrett and Flair touched on their promo, this got this. You know, I think we've got another match come up first, but that
we have
that tag match does have a stipulation. I'll say as much, where the loser has to kiss the winner's backside. Which is why Dusty Rhodes is making sure that his backside is absolutely rancid. So, you know, if you're a non-wrestling fan watching this year, you're going to think, what the hell? But for those of us who know Dusty well and are going to watch wrestling regardless of what happens, and who have just survived the Vince Russo era, it was mildly amusing in an offbeat way.
Yeah, I wasn't a fan
to some of us.
It's just so, yeah. Okay, match number 8 is for the United States Championship, Booker T versus Rick Steiner. And do you know something? It crossed my mind when this match started. It's amazing to think that Booker T had the same entrance music throughout his time as a tag team wrestler in WCW, a singles wrestler in WCW, and then a singles wrestler in the WWE.
Yeah, I love the fact that he was synonymous with it, and it was a great theme, so why...
Oh, yeah, damn good music. But, yeah, it's just, you know, how many other wrestlers, apart from, you know, the likes of a Ric Flair, but even there were different versions of things, you know, can say they've had that same tune throughout.
That's very true.
This is another sort of paint-by-numbers match, I call it, but the crowd are very much into it. Steiner pulls the referee into the path of a Booker T high kick, and as always with the referees in WCW, they can't sell getting bumped. You'd have thought that, you know, they'd have been given some kind of basic training on how to sell something realistically. With the ref down, your new mate Shane Douglas, who's got an issue with Steiner already, hops the rail, and as Steiner climbs to the second rope, Douglas hits him with a cast that he's got on his wrist. And yep, if you're keeping score, the exact same thing happened in the previous match with the cast that Canyon had on his wrist. Steiner sells that just as badly as a ref bump, but Booker T hits the bookend and becomes the new United States champion. And obviously he would add the world title to his resume just 8 days later on the last ever Nitro.
He would indeed, and it kind of really frustrated me just how the guy who lost the world title to Scott Steiner, guy who'd been minted as a main event and the guy who's next in line to challenge for the belt, he was given hardly anything in this match. And much like with Sean Stasiak earlier, Rick Steiner, especially at this level, at this stage of his career, really did drag everyone else down to his level. He, you know, his selling was abysmal. His offense was tedious. He'd ensure he was controlling most of the match as well. And as a result, one of the hottest performers in the company is having this like mediocre pedestrian match with the dog-faced gremlin. Shane Douglas's interference as well. Booker T shouldn't need that to win the belt. He should be squashing guys like Steiner and then saying, right, your brother's next, and then you build it up. But there is a back issue there. So Shane Douglas won the US title from Hugh Morris as a heel, as his typical heel persona. He then lost it only a couple of weeks later to Rick Steiner, who's pretending to be a babyface until he could turn on Kevin Nash and reveal that he was part of the Magnificent Seven later in the show. So you've got a heel who's got a beef with what turns out to be another heel. They want to keep it going, so have Shane Douglas come out and cost him it. And I'm not sure where they were going with this, but it looked like they were going to do a Rick and Douglas feud where Shane Douglas was... It was reminiscent of early Shield, you know, 10 years before the Shield were doing it, where he had like he was taking video camera footage of himself and challenging Rick Steiner and, you know, showing up out of the crowd and interfering, and he was trying to do some sort of rogue renegade. I really don't understand it, but obviously we never got the chance to see it, because if they would have had a payoff on the finale of Nitro. It was bought by WWE, and WWE didn't want either of them on their show. So yeah, we never did find out where that went.
It also makes me wonder if it was a way of, you know, the interference was a way of placating Rick Steiner into doing the job and losing the title.
Oh, massively so, which makes it all the more frustrating. He can't give, you know, this ain't some other up-and-comer that he's been asked to put over. Like, say, let's say that Luger and Bagwell did exactly that, which is probably likely. You know, they're doing this with O'Hare and Palumbo, and you think, all right, well, I can see why. I don't agree with it, but I can see why. Rick Steiner's doing this to Booker T, who, for all intents and purposes, he should be the face of the company right now. And he was about to become the face of it right at the end, because WWE very much wanted him with the belt when they bought it, and they wanted to actually use him. So, and he's doing this, and it's just a joke. So, good riddance, Rick Steiner. Bye-bye. Don't let the door hit your ass on the way out.
Okay, we have then more backstage footage on the camcorder with Luger arguing with Road Warrior Animal, and then it is time for one of the feature matches, one of the ones that people have been looking forward to. As you said earlier on, Liam, this is in Florida, which was, you know, one of the mainstay areas of Dusty Rhodes' career. It's Ric Flair and Jeff Jarrett v. Dusty and Dustin Rhodes. Flair comes out in a Hawaiian shirt, slacks, and black shoes. He says he's not wrestling, he's not dressed to wrestle, then he immediately proceeds to wrestle. And it's notable that Flair also wrestled with a T-shirt on at the final Nitro 8 days later. So, I mean, what was going on there?
So, as covered in Flair's autobiography, I believe, at this stage of his career, he was hideously out of shape, which, if he feels that way, that he wants to make sure his upper body's covered for a couple of matches, and then he went on to continue to wrestle for another 7, 8, 9 years with massive flabby tits. You can imagine how self-conscious he's feeling at this point. And by all accounts, he was an all-time low. He was happy those two went under. He was really miserable there last couple of years. So he did not want to be wrestling topless. So this was a really lame, half-assed explanation as to why. Him saying, I'm not dressed to wrestle, then suddenly changing his mind. Suppose it's meant to be a heel swerve, but it doesn't come off. He's just out there in a Hawaiian shirt. Because he's feeling self-conscious.
It was a good Hawaiian shirt, mind you.
It was a cracking Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah. So Dusty comes out to what is basically a terrible pastiche of his Common Man theme tune from WWF. And then Scott Hudson, this blew my mind. Scott Hudson informs us of the almost unbelievable fact that this is the first time that Flair and Dusty have ever wrestled each other on a pay-per-view. Because all the matches they had previously, all the times they headlined back in the 80s, was before pay-per-view existed. It was, you know, closed-circuit television and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So that was pretty incredible. And also, of course, there's the fact that Flair and Dusty, who at this point have a combined age of 107, are in the second from top match on a pay-per-view in 2001. But there you go.
Very true, but to be fair, when they're commanding this sort of reaction from the crowd, and they've got two very capable, very reliable, very good workers in there with them, why not? I enjoyed this. It was a borderline comedy match, but I enjoyed every second of it.
Yeah, so as you touched on previously, the loser out of Flair and Dusty must kiss the winner's backside. A huge pop for Dusty when he gets in the ring with Flair. You know, nostalgia always gets a pop if done sparingly, as Rey Mysterio and the Hurricane at the Rumble showed, I guess. Yeah. And a lot of the female surprises as well. They're only in briefly for now, with Dusty landing a bionic elbow on Flair. And understandably, Dustin Rhodes and Jarrett are in for the majority of the match here. There's a hot tag to Dusty, and everyone's bumping for him. Kind of like the old when you used to see all Japan matches with Giant Baba, and he couldn't do much, but everyone bumped for him out of respect for what the guy had done. There's stereo figure fours from the heels. They get countered. In the end, Dustin pins Flair with a messy-looking small package for the win. So, as you said, Flair must kiss Dusty's ass after Dusty's supposedly chowed down through a ton of burritos. He takes his jeans down, which isn't the most pleasant sight in the world. He rubs his backside vaguely near Jarrett's face for the pop, and the heels retreat to the back. You're paying for this. It was a fun match. I didn't care too much for the stipulation, but the match itself was a fun one-off nostalgia novelty kind of match, and it worked well. It kind of, it, yeah, you often want a sometimes when you're constructing the wrestling card, you want a bit of a come down match or a bit of a comedy match. And there's an element of comedy here, but there's also with nostalgia, there's that feel good mood in it. It changes the mood and lightens the crowd up ready for the main event, basically.
Yeah, it's done exactly that. As I said, I did enjoy this match. And yeah, I suppose the one gripe I'd have is, you know, this, technically it's a, you know, one of those things in wrestling that really sours a crowd in the long run is failure to uphold stipulations. And technically, you know, Flair hasn't kissed Dusty's ass here on the night, and people have paid for this. I'd dare say that of all the things paying customers would happily let slip by is the sight of two old men kissing each other's asses. But I can say that there was a payoff for this the following night on Nitro, which I found just alarmingly humorous. It's one of them things, you know, I disqualified your use of guilty pleasure for Ernest Miller because he's a flat out pleasure. I love him. But their segment with these four men the following night on Nitro was a guilty pleasure for me. I found it hilarious where, you know, even though it should have happened at the pay-per-view and they shouldn't be doing this thing where they just drag it out onto free TV if someone's fought out, they extend it and Dusty's like, well, you know, you didn't do it at the pay-per-view, but you still owe me an ass-kissing, so you're going to kiss my ass, he said. And he literally brought out an ass. He brought out a donkey, and on the donkey's backside, it said Dusty's ass. And just that visual, I thought, was hilarious. So they did a thing where the heels jumped the Rhodesies and dragged them over, and they were going to give them a taste of their own mission. And then you get the old, you know, when you're about to ram someone in the turnbuckle and they stop and get the elbows in, then do it to you. And I've done it, only the turnbuckle is a donkey's backside. And it was a great way to end the penultimate Nitro ever. You think I'm being sarcastic? I suppose it could be construed as sarcasm, but I thought it was funny. It was a great thing. I loved it.
I'm going to have to watch the penultimate Nitro ever, aren't I?
It's on the network.
Yeah. It's interesting what you say about stipulations, because I was reading an interview in Total Wrestling magazine not long ago with Tommy Dreamer, and talking about House of Hardcore, which you went along to see.
Yes.
And you know, he's talking about how one thing that he took from or had drummed into him from Paul Heyman when he ran ECW was the fact that, you know, one thing about ECW was that they always honoured stipulations. So, you know, when, for example, I remember when the Bad Breed, Ian and Axel Rotten, lost a loser must split up match to, I think it was Public Enemy, they never ever teamed again. And it's, and Dreamer said, you know, it's the same in House of Hardcore, that you'll never see Dreamer and Bueller coming out together. You'll never see Dreamer teaming up with Terry Funk because of stipulations that have happened in there, you know. And so it does make a huge difference. It really does, because, you know, otherwise, what's the point of stipulations, basically?
Yeah, it's the very foundation of repeat custom. It goes for any business model. And if wrestling, in its carniness, thinks it can escape it, well, this is why promotions come and go so much.
Yeah. Okay, it's main event time. 10 matches, which, thinking about the Russo era when we'd have 13 or 14 matches on the card, this is a bit better. It is for a Falls Count Anywhere match for the WCW World title between Diamond Dallas Page and Scott Steiner. So Michael Buffer is our ring announcer, and I know we agree to disagree on this, but I still find it that it's amazing that a company that's bleeding so much money is still hiring Michael Buffer to announce one match on each of their pay-per-views. You know, it's a nice touch, but at the same time, no one's going to stop ordering pay-per-views because Buffer's gone.
Yeah, no, I agree. I love it, personally, on a selfish way. It is a nice touch, as you put it, but business-wise, I'm with you. Why the hell are they still doing it?
Yeah, so he announces that this match will have a stipulation that it must end with a winner by either pinfall or submission. Is that the same as every single wrestling match that's ever been in history?
Well, every single match with a no DQ or must... Yeah, so it's no odds bar. I think they announced it's Falls Count Anywheres. So yeah, basically it's not going to be any cop-out. So I don't mind it. If it has to end by pinfall and submission, it means you're not going to get a schmoz.
Yes, what he means to say, I think, is it's no disqualification, but because he doesn't have a clue about wrestling and no one's bothered to check properly, he ends up coming out with that.
Yeah, I think you're right there. But I did, you know, I like the story coming into this match. Because we've skipped from New Blood Rising to here, I'll do a brief recap. Basically, Scott Steiner won the WCW title from Booker T at Mayhem in November. He put Booker on the shelf after the match, because Booker needed a mild bit of surgery. He took out Sting as well. And then he embarked on a big killing spree where he wipes out Sid Vicious, Kevin Nash. And now DDP is regarded as his last high-profile target. Paige played it up in a good way, I thought, where he would say he's the last man standing, and every time he'd have a run-in with Scott and Nitro get beaten up, he'd say, I'm still standing. Scott would always be like, no, you're not the last man standing. I've just saved you for last. Everyone knows they've had bad blood on and off throughout WCW, so there's a certain electricity to those two having a match anyway. And they're going to have a big stipulation match. So
is that where they'd supposedly retired Kevin Nash previously?
Yes,
is that
Super Bowl revenge. They did the same technically to Sid at Sin, although Sid kind of did it to himself with that infamous, gruesome injury when he tried a big boot off the top rope like a moron.
Ah, yes.
But yeah, the idea was, and this was the formation of Magnificent Seven as well, where it turns out that Ric Flair has been facilitating Scott Steiner's reign of terror all along. They've got Road Warrior Animal, they've got Jarrett, they've got Rick Steiner, they've got Bagwell and Luger, they've got seven of them. They're running roughshod. Steiner's taken them all out, and Paige is the last one left, although we've had Booker T make his return and say, right, I'm going to get you, Scott. No matter what happens this match, I'm going to get you. So they're still carrying it on, even though it's technically the last one to take out. And these two proceed to have a good brawl, as you'd expect from these two, to be honest.
And you know, it's good as well, because, you know, I mean, you know, you've got the heel champion, or, well, regardless of whether he's a heel or face, you've got the champion who has got people gunning for him and people gunning for that title. And once again, it goes back to what I said about making the world title the focal point of a promotion.
Yeah, and yet there was also that great thing about, you know, crazy deranged Scott Steiner, where even though people were hunting him, anyone who changed him for the title was pretty much run the risk of having their career ended in kayfabe.
Yeah.
So it made them high stakes, even though the last two main events were pretty farcical because the match with Nash was abysmal. The four-way fell apart when Sid hurt his leg. But this is the one match of that Scott Steiner reign, that one pay-per-view match that really hit the notes. That being said, I have to point out there was a glorious Because WCW moment when they're brawling in the crowd and they're playing up the Falls Count Anywhere stipulation. There is a kid on crutches, a young man on crutches, who's he's awkwardly lurking around in such an unrealistic way that even someone watching wrestling for the first time will go, that's a plant, that's a guy who's supposed to be there. And it gets better.
In a DDP t-shirt, no less.
Yeah, it gets better because Scott Steiner snatches the poor cripple's crutches away, beats Paige with them, and the plant walks away.
Well, he gets shoved down first of all.
Yeah, but he gets up and he walks away. He walks on his legs.
And do you know who that plant is?
Go on.
That plant was, I recognised it as soon as I saw it and I had to check it on Wikipedia. That planted fan was none other than a very young Paul London.
Oh, man. I didn't even know. I was too busy laughing at what happened. But, yeah. Wow.
See, I was too busy going, holy shit, that's Paul London, to notice the fact that he walked away. And you were too busy noticing that he walked away to see it's Paul London. So, you see, that's why we host this together, because, you know, between the two of us. Exactly.
We got each other's backs.
Yeah. I've got to say as well that I loved that. You know, the chain link headdress that Scott Steiner wore? It looked ridiculous, but I loved it.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I think it just made him stand out even more than he already did with his ridiculous physique.
That's professional wrestling. You know, the ridiculous is the sublime. And the ridiculous things that are terrible, there really is a fine line between what works and what doesn't work. And that's why I've always cut some slack for people who try but fail. But if someone just does something absurd, I'm looking at you, Mr. Russo, that is going to get no love. But yeah, that Scott Steiner's persona, his look, the sirens music, he had it all clicked, and it did make for a great persona.
It's a fearsome reputation, not just in the ring, but, you know, stories from backstage. But, you know, it goes back, and I may have said this before, but it's worth repeating, that one thing I, when I, if I do like managers promos or just character promos, I'm doing one shortly for Revolution Pro Wrestling, actually. One thing I say, it's something that my mentor, the late Andre Baker, may he rest in peace, said to me, if people wanted to see two people who look like their next door neighbors having a fight, they'd go to the pub. And that wrestling, you have to be larger than life. You have to stand out. And one thing I say to anyone who wants to be a manager or is like trying to develop a character or anything like that, especially as a manager, if you are coming out in clothes that you would be comfortable walking down the street in, then you're not doing your job properly.
And that explains a lot of your shirts. Now it makes sense why you'd come out in some of those shirts you did. Okay.
You see, when I'm... I mean, I don't do it all that often these days. I'm more doing other things. But when, you know, if I do the manager gimmick, I come out in sunglasses and an Arab headdress because I'm half Arabic, legit. And I also have a jacket on that's got Twisted Genius written in the back in sequins. I would not walk down to the local shops for a pint of milk wearing that. So, yeah, that's the point I'm trying to make there. Anyway, back to this match. It starts off quick And again, this has got the intensity of a world title match, the intensity of a main event, but you know you're always going to get that with DDP.
Yeah, he plans out his matches quite well. Someone like Scott Steiner, even when he's a great big bloated mass of muscle, he knows the business inside and out. He can easily follow a meticulous routine. And these two play off of the vibes people get when they see him in the same place. And they turned life into art quite well. I really enjoyed this main event.
So there was there legit backstage heat between these two then, or what was the story?
Oh yeah, they had a backstage fight only a few months before this, I believe, where Scott Steiner had pretty much throughout his WWE run made it clear that he did not like Kimberly Page. I think the exact details have been documented somewhere else. And DDP, when he came over to the UK last autumn for his tour, he did address this without going into massive details. But basically, you know, he can't stand Kimberly. He got really unprofessional about his hatred for Kimberly. She presumably told, you know, anyone who listened, including her husband, like, well, you know, this ain't fair. What are you going to do about it? Paige saw fit to defend his wife. They got into a fight. By all accounts, you know, Paige stood his ground, but Steiner's a monster and overpowered him and hurt him. So if you look at, I think it was around November, December 2000.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, this is the time that the internet is there and backstage news and rumours are there, and the hardcore fans that would still be watching WCW would most definitely be people who would be looking things up on the internet. So that all makes sense, I guess. So, so as the match gets in back into the ring, which kind of telegraphs that the finish will be coming. Steiner's got a cut on his forehead. The match is building nicely towards a finish. DDP hits a diamond cutter, but Rick Steiner appears out of nowhere, pulls referee Nick Patrick out of the ring, and the crowd chant bullshit. With the ref down, Page gets hit with the title belt across his head, and Page is now bleeding as well. This is going to sound really geeky, but it's something I always do. I try and look at where and when they've bladed, and I really couldn't see any point where he bladed, but he obviously must have done it. But yeah, so he did it very well. Steiner executes a Boston Crab. DDP gets the ropes. Steiner puts him in the Steiner recliner, and DDP's face is absolutely covered in blood. So it's, I guess, a bit reminiscent of the classic Bret Hart, Stone Cold Steve Austin visual of Austin in the sharpshoot with the blood pouring down his face. They're trying to do something like that. With the ref distracted, Rick lands some right hands and Scott gets a few shots in with a lead pipe, and a second Steiner recliner results in DDP passing out and Steiner retaining his world title. So it's kind of, you know, DDP never tapped, he just passed out from the blood loss. It's a great visual. Tony Schiavone puts over Scott Steiner's dominance in WCW.
yeah, it would only last another 8 days, but job done. Yeah, I mean, having Rick Steiner out there really annoyed me, because it was bad enough having him pretend to be someone important in his own match, let alone here. But, you know, maybe if WCW were to carry on, I'm guessing Slamboree or something would have DDP versus Rick Steiner. So, it makes a little bit of sense in that way. But no, good match. Scott Steiner continues his thing of taking out everyone. You've got the big hope with Booker T. And if it doesn't finish in 8 days' time, you've got Goldberg coming back. Because all these backstage attacks, because one happened at, during the segments with a camcorder on this pay-per-view, and a couple have happened on Nitro. It was being speculated as to whether or not it would be Sting returning or Goldberg returning. You had both of those returns to play on. So, you know, Magnificent Seven were on the verge of getting a comeuppance. Booker T getting the belt, Sting and Goldberg taking them out, and you move on with the rest of it in the Fusion era. Something which would have been really promising because, you know, they've got a lot of... Yeah, there's a lot more logic to the show in general. They've got more cruiserweight action. As you and I can attest, the pay-per-views are more watchable even at times when they are a little bit WCW. It's still much better than what they were during that fateful era that really tanked them as a company. And they, you know, by all accounts, it looked like they were going to sign Rob Van Dam. Pretty much had a verbal agreement to join the Fusion WCW. Don Callis was going to come in. They would have had their, you know, I think a couple of ECW guys had already gone to WWF and a couple had come over here, such as Easy Money. But there were still a lot of people to pick from the Tajiris of the world.
So this is
where it gets a bit painful, because knowing this is the last pay-per-view, you know, it's 8 days away. Look, WCW, and this is the whole point of this podcast, it was ludicrous. It was mind-numbing at times, but there was so much goodness in with the bad. And the worst thing, the worst thing that could have happened for wrestling is to lose it. And the frustrating thing about TNA will be that they had a serious chance to take up the WCW mantle, albeit they would have never given WWE any actual head-to-head competition. But they, yeah, in my opinion, late 2005, early 2006, and then even late on around 2012 when they promoted the likes of Rude and Storm, they had two periods where they were a legitimate alternative and a great place for other wrestlers to get employed. And that's the important thing of this. People get jobs if there's an alternative, even if they are clearly second from beginning to end. Don't implode. But WCW and TNA insisted on doing that, unfortunately.
And the thing is, you know, you look at American wrestling history, and the times that Vince McMahon has put a killer product out has been when there has been stiff competition. You know, you look at the Monday Night Wars, you look at the Attitude Era, go back even further, you know, this would be a great show for us to cover, actually. It was when Clash of the Champions 6, Flair v. Steamboat, was on the same day as WrestleMania 5. So you had Flair v. Steamboat on one side, Hogan v. Savage on another side, and, you know, just amazing, amazing products being put out. And the thing about this show, and, you know, we've talked about this off air previously, Liam, is that, you know, this it had a few duds, it had a few flaws in logic, but all in all, this was a decent show. And it was almost like things were just starting to get going again. The young, you know, you had younger guys starting to get noticed. Like we said, your AJ Styles, Air Paris, Elix Skipper, people like that. A new cruiserweight tag division had been launched, but it was just all a matter of too little too late, because 8 days later, WCW was bought by Vince McMahon, the Monday Night Wars were over, and WCW, as we know it, ceased to exist. Really sad.
Yeah, it's such a sad scenario and a case of what if that... I think the most pathetic and geekiest of diehard fans would probably feel compelled to write a massive fan fiction about what would have happened if Fusion had bought WCW.
Who'd do that?
Who'd do an awful thing like that? Maybe I'll provide the link.
Do you still have it somewhere, do you?
I do very much. Maybe I should open it, because, you know, the guys listening to this would be WCW lovers like us. Maybe I could feel comfortable opening up the Google Doc to people who listen to this. If a couple of people want it, love to get some feedback. Why not? I still write it to this day. I'm up to Full Brawl 2002, so I've taken them some way.
Hey, if you would like to hear that, if you'd like to get in touch with us at all, then please, you can follow us on Twitter at BecauseWCW. You can contact us on Facebook, facebook.com/BecauseWCW as well. We would love to hear from you. So we told you right at the top of the podcast, we are now available on IWN Live Network. And for a special thank you to you, our listeners, you can get yourself a 20% discount for 6 months. The usual price is $4.99. You get 20% of that off, which I think off the top of my head is a pound off. I can't argue with that. If you put in the code 20 because WCW, that's no spaces and that's all in block capitals, 20 because WCW, and that code will expire on the 13th of June this year. So get that in, 20 because WCW. That's our little thank you to you for listening to us. Thanks for listening. Now, before we go away, it is, of course, time for our theme tune. Well, I was going to say theme tune of the week, but we don't do this weekly. But it's whatever. We'll call it that anyway. Theme of the week. It's my turn, I believe, this time around, isn't it?
It is indeed, then.
Okay, press play.
I will.
So you're hearing this. Who do you immediately think of?
Yeah, because I know you touched upon the fact that this is a recycled theme. This was used for more than one WCW wrestler, but for me, and I'm sure a lot of other people listen, it's only the second man to use it that really comes to mind, and that is one Rey Mysterio Jr.
Indeed. However, I don't know. It never really quite fitted for me. This is, you know, this is the music of a dangerous plodding monster or something, and I think, you know, the music that he had in WWE is far more fitting. And the person that had this music before him couldn't be more different to Rey Mysterio if you tried. It was the man known in WCW as Loch Ness, better known to British fans as the legendary Giant Haystacks. So on the one hand, you have Rey Mysterio, about, what, 5'3", 140, 150 pounds, one of the most innovative, high-flying wrestlers of all time. And on the other hand, you have Giant Haystacks, Loch Ness, 6'11", 600 pounds. By this stage, barely mobile. You couldn't have, you know, when we listened to the music was used by Steve McMichael and Hardcore Hack, the Sandman, you know, we were able to say, well, you know, there are kind of similarities to these guys. You can see why they got the same music. With these two, you couldn't have two more different people.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Haystacks at some point in his life probably ate a lunch the size of Rey Mysterio.
Yes. And that's about as much as they have in common, I think. But it's just, to me, it's more for Haystacks than Mysterio for me.
Yeah, you know, at first it kind of worked for Mysterio. He's a masked luchador, literally called Mysterio. He's got that mystique. No one knows too much about him in this day and age. Only a very small pocket of the wrestling fan base had seen him wrestle in Mexico, and obviously a cup of coffee in ECW as well. So it worked very early doors, but before too long, he was talking to the fans. He was well established. He was a multi-time cruiserweight champion, and the theme just didn't stick anymore. So it was time for him to evolve. It's a shame that he evolved with such terrible fucking hip-hop music that he ended up having. I think Kurt Hennig had it spot on in his feud with Rey Mysterio and friends when he said, "Rap is crap."
Oh, I like a bit of rap,
but not this rap. Not Master not P. This.
Not God, and the No Limit Soldiers. Oh, there's another story for another day.
Yeah.
WCW and their so-called celebrity tie-ins. Anyway, it is time for us to wrap up. Thank you ever so much for downloading this episode of Because WCW. It's been been a pleasure. Thank you very much. As I said, you can get hold of us on Twitter at Because WCW. Please give us a follow. If you're listening via the IWN network, thank you for joining us on there, and you can hear me on the next IPW show coming up in February and March. So on behalf of my co-host Liam Happ, this is the Twisted Genius Dean Ayers saying thanks for joining us. I'll see you ringside.